Kentucky. Louisville, East Kentucky. Louisville, you're from Illinois.
I know it seems odd to show up unannounced at this time of night, and it's so nice to meet you. Emery simpered as we led him into the shop. While I dearly love doing the Lord's work, I'm so glad to be back here. I spent many hours as a child in the store, poring over the books.
Really? I said, arching a brow. It's just that they're all, you know, occult books. Mr. Wainwright said you were very devout, even as a child. He said you tried to baptize him with bottled water when you were 9.
Emery flushed pink and cleared his throat. Yes, well, spending time here was a taste of the forbidden fruit. I was fascinated by the books because they were so different from anything in my house. It drove my mother crazy.
Mr. Wainwright appeared behind Emery and nodded.
He did spend a lot of time here. And it was his predilection for the wood carvings of the nude rituals practiced by Eastern European vampire clans that upset his mother. I had to hide all the books that bared what his mother called lady bumps. It was horrifying.
Dick excused himself so he could go out to the parking lot and laugh. I was stuck chewing on my lip and praying for a straight face. I flipped on the light switch, and Gilbert gave a loud gasp at the appearance of the shop.
It's so different.
Yes, well, we've renovated extensively since you were here last.
You must have spent a fortune, he exclaimed. It's certainly nicer than anything in the neighborhood. You might have outpaced yourself there.
I shot a what the hell look at Dick, who had just walked back in.
And look, everything is so orderly. You could find anything you wanted now. Uncle Gilbert never did have a head for alphabetizing. Emery smirked. But I guess he had you for that, among other things. He wrote to me about you once. He was very fond of you, a young, pretty vampire girl who was willing to spend so much time with him. Obviously, he had to be fond of you if he sank all his money into renovating the shop and leaving it to you. I'm glad he had someone to make his last month so pleasurable, someone who took care of him, even if it was only an employee.
Call me oversensitive, but had Emery just implied that I exchanged sexual favors for cash and redecorating?
I don't think I appreciate what he's implying,
Mr. Wainwright said, staring at his nephew. Me neither, I muttered, to which Emery gave me a confused look. I cleared my throat. Mr. Mueller, I don't want you to get the wrong idea about my relationship with Mr. Wainwright and how his will was written. I didn't set out to take over the shop or get in good with your uncle. I was just lucky enough to be hired by one of the sweetest men on earth, and he became a close friend. I didn't know he planned on leaving me the shop, and I wasn't even sure I was going to keep it at first. In fact, I was thinking very seriously of selling.
Oh, I think that's for the best, the right thing to do, Emery said quickly. I'll do anything I can to help speed things along.
I was caught off guard by his sudden enthusiasm. Who was he to be so enthusiastic about tossing out his uncle's legacy, especially when that legacy technically belonged to me now?
Give him what for, Jane? Mr. Wainwright said,
smirking at what he recognized was my temper building. Emery wasn't smart enough to see it himself. As I was saying, I thought about selling, but I decided the best way to honor your uncle's memory would be to keep this place going. So I sank my own money into renovations. It didn't cost your uncle a penny. And the business seems to be taking off, so we're not going to be closing anytime soon. For now, anything you want to take, you're welcome to, especially stuff from his personal effects or private collections. He didn't spell that out in the will, but I wouldn't feel right keeping everything.
That's very kind of you, Emery sighed, picking up his duffel. For now, I'm going upstairs to bed. I'm sorry if I'm being rude. I'm just so tired. Jet lag, you know.
Oh, I said, exchanging a look with Mr. Wainwright. Actually, there's no apartment there anymore. We turned it into storage and office space. I can recommend some hotels in town, though, depending on how long you're planning on staying. Emery's lips thinned in a way that showed that he was clearly insulted by this change.
I see. I didn't anticipate that.
I'm very sorry, I said. If I'd known you were coming, I would have made hotel arrangements for you.
I don't enjoy hotels,
Emery said sulkily.
You never know who's stayed in the room before you, or whether the facilities have been cleaned properly.
He is absolutely phobic about germs, Mr. Wainwright chuckled. But only American germs for some reason. He thinks people in other countries are cleaner than we are. Don't let him talk you into staying with you, Jane. The last time he was a guest in my house, I woke up at 3 a.m. to find him steam cleaning the inside of my dishwasher.
The thought of Emery staying with me hadn't even occurred to me. Yes, I had room to put Emery at my house, but no. I was not inviting a mouth-breathing stranger into my home, a vaguely rude mouth-breathing stranger at that. I wondered if Dick would invite him to stay at Andrea's place. But given the way Emery was fastidiously wiping at his hands with hand sanitizer, as if we had some sort of germ that was more powerful than what they had in Guatemala, Dick didn't seem inclined to bond with him. Come on, Emery, Dick said, taking Emery's duffel bag onto his shoulder and patting him on the back. I know a good boarding house in town. Very clean. The owner owes me a favor. I'll get you settled in. Dick escorted Emery to his car and came back into the shop under the guise of forgetting something. That's the fruit of my loins? I think your jeans lost their mojo somewhere along the way, I teased. Dick was indignant. Those are not my jeans. Margaret must have mated with a jellyfish or something. Mr. Wainwright shook his head.
You're not too far off.
Look at Gilbert.
He wasn't exactly strapping when he was young, but he had guts. He had gumption. He wasn't afraid of hotel sheets. Thank you, Dick, Mr. Wainwright said, smiling proudly. And you, Dick cried. What are you thinking telling him he can have anything he wants from the stock? What if he runs off with something valuable?
Well, he's probably got more rights to anything here than I do, I said. Mr. Wainwright winced.
Oh, please, don't say that in front of him, dear. He'll take everything that's not nailed down and donate the proceeds to a questionable charity.
Are you softening up to the doughy young missionary? Dick asked me. There's nothing wrong with missionaries, I said, grinning at him. Besides, he is your great-great-grandson, your own flesh and blood, and we both know you could use a little churching up. It might be interesting for you to talk to him, to hear things from his point of view. Dick made a sour face.
His point of view is that we're evil and should be struck through the heart with a stake wrapped in wild roses.
Wow, that seems harsh. Dick walked out, putting his determined-to-be-polite face on. I busied myself with getting the coffee bar ready for that night's crowd.
How have you been, Jane, dear?
Mr. Wainwright asked.
Your aunt told me about your difficulties with Gabriel. She said you took it rather hard.
Well, after going through the female and male breakup recovery rituals, I can determine that, one, I'm going to be okay, and two, the male breakup ritual is more fun, but harder to heal up from. I'm fine, really. I'm just keeping busy and trying not to think about it.
I can haunt Gabriel's house for you if you'd like,
Mr. Wainwright offered. Thank you, that's very sweet, but I don't think you can really scare someone after you've spent Christmas Eve with them. Unless you're my Grandma Ruthie. Mr. Wainwright chuckled. I rummaged through the drawers behind the bar and then got on my hands and knees, searching for the tiny canister of vampire mace. It had obviously been detached from my key ring at some point, and it didn't show up in a thorough post-fight search of my purse and house, and it wasn't the sort of thing I wanted lying around the shop. Mr. Wainwright, have you seen a little metal tube about the size of a chapstick? I asked, lifting a chaise long with one hand to search under it. Mr. Wainwright, who was always entertained by my feats of vampire strength, shook his head. Great. Either I'm going to have to wait for Fitz to pass it, or pray I don't step on it and mace myself. The front bell rang, and Zeb walked into the shop, pale and shaking. Wordlessly, he walked to the coffee bar and climbed onto a stool. I snapped my fingers in front of his face. Zeb, are you okay? What's wrong? Is it Jolene? Is the baby okay? Did one of Jolene's relatives get trapped by the Department of Fish and Wildlife? Did the police find your dad still? What?
Two of them, he said, his eyes oddly dilated.
One of Jolene's relatives was trapped by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the police found your dad still? What are the odds of that? I wondered. He snapped out of his funk long enough to look annoyed with me.
No. Two of them. On the ultrasound. There's two babies.
Twins? I laughed. But that's great, and considering the number of multiple births in Jolene's family, not entirely unexpected.
Congratulations, Mr. Wainwright cried,
and then he caught sight of Zeb's stricken expression.
I'll be going now.
Zeb scrubbed his hand over his face as Mr. Wainwright faded out of sight.
I was prepared for one baby. I don't know if I can handle two.
It's a little late for that. There's a very strict no-return policy on babies.
I don't know what I'm going to do, Jane.
Well, what do you want me to do? Take one off your hands? There's not much I can do except pay someone else to babysit. Are they boys or girls? I asked.
Don't know yet. It's too early to tell. To be honest, I didn't catch much after two heartbeats. One of them was doing a sort of Homer Simpson shimmy. I'm guessing that's the one that takes after me.
Look at it this way. You're lucky it's not triplets or quadruplets. That seemed to cheer him. If you keep going, you can form your own basketball team, I suggested. He furrowed his brow and frowned at me. Too soon? He nodded. I'll fix you some herbal tea. It's soothing, I said, patting his hand. How's Jolene? Is she craving pickles and ice cream yet? Zeb groaned.
If only. It's more like Canadian bacon and ice cream. Peanut butter and turkey sandwiches. Tuna, noodle, pie. She actually made what she called bacon chip cookies the other day. A chocolate chip cookie recipe with bacon pieces instead of chocolate chips. She said it's her body's way of getting as much protein as possible for the babies. But I swear, if I see her eat one more of those pies, I'm going to yark.
Well, the good news is whenever I regret not being able to eat, I'll call those images to mind. I'll never want solid food again, I shuddered, rubbing my stomach. Zeb perked up as he said,
By the way, I got a call from the reunion committee today. They wanted some pictures of you for the memorial wall.
But I'm not dead, Zeb smirked.
Well, that's not the way the committee sees it.
That's it. I'm not going to this thing.
Oh, come on,
he said, accepting a cup of chamomile.
You've got to go to the reunion. It'll be fun. You can scare the crap out of all our former classmates.
It will be fun for you. You're married to a beautiful woman who adores you to the point that she'll probably maul the first doofus who tries to give you a commemorative wedgie, and she'll be pregnant so everyone will know you've had sex with her. I, however, will most likely be going solo, which will probably just cement all those lesbian rumors. Oh, wait, dead lesbian rumors.
So you haven't made up with Gabriel yet, huh?
I shook my head. Cindy, the goth good luck charm, walked through the door, acknowledged me with a nod, and headed for the graphic novels. You know, I used to be alone, and I got along just fine. It's simpler this way. Less messy, less complicated. Less time wondering what the hell is going on in my own life and whether it's my fault. At least this way, I know it's my fault. Zeb grimaced.
Well, that's cheerful.
I do what I can, I said, shrugging as the front doorbell rang. I met a really nice doctor the other night, and then he saw me beat a guy senseless, so I don't think he's going to want me to call.
You beat some guy senseless?
Zeb cried. Dick made an attempt to cheer me up. It was either a bar fight or cow tipping. Zeb's nose wrinkled.
You and Dick have a complicated relationship.
I shrugged. I put a mocha latte on the counter for Cindy and left it out for her. Like cookies and milk for an emo Santa Claus. Besides, Adam Murrow's going to be there, and I'm still feeling a little weird about him. I'd had a huge crush on Adam since elementary school. He was the blonde, dimpled football hero to my tuba-toting band geek. I never really got over that teeny bopper obsession with him, which was why it was so difficult for me to see that his efforts to get reacquainted a few months before had nothing to do with me and everything to do with Adam's weirdo sexual fascination with vampires. It turned out that despite attending school with me for 12 years, he hadn't remembered the name of that egghead who used to annoy him in class until someone reminded him at my almost Grandpa Bob's funeral. I dropped Adam like a clove of garlic and mended damaged fences with Gabriel before it was too late. Of course, I didn't realize at the time that it was already too late and Gabriel had moved on to Janine. I've really got to work on rerouting my thought process so every subject doesn't come back to Gabriel. It seemed unfair that I felt some measure of breakup anxiety over Adam when we never technically went out. But to this day, I couldn't even hear his name without a rush of guilt and embarrassment. I would have enough to deal with at the reunion, such as my placement on the memorial wall, without delving into those issues again.
But crushing Adam's hopes and dreams is going to make the reunion even better. You, the untouchable hottie that he can't, well, touch. It's going to be such a blow to his ego, Zeb exclaimed. I never told you this because you had that thing for him in school, but I always wanted to just punch that guy in the face with his, oh, I'm tall and blonde and dreamy and everybody loves me because I'm such a nice guy, shtick. Maybe there were other guys in the class who were just as nice. Maybe there were some guys in the class who should have been swing choir president but didn't get elected because Adam was so dreamy. Maybe there were some guys who wanted to take Dawn Farber to homecoming but ended up going stag because Dawn was holding out for Adam just in case.
Maybe you shouldn't go to the reunion, I said, sorting through the day's mail. Should I start putting horse tranquilizers in your tea? As Zeb ranted on, I sifted through the day's mail, mostly bills and publishers' catalogs. An ivory linen paper envelope slipped out and fluttered to the counter. I stared at it for a moment, wondering if I was imagining the spidery black writing that spelled out my name and the shop address. There was no return label. The postmark was in Half Moon Hollow.
You okay, Janie?
Zeb asked, reaching over to jiggle my shoulder.
You're pale. Paler than usual.
I nodded and handed the heavy envelope to Zeb. My hands were shaking.
Could you open that for me?
Zeb arched an eyebrow, concern stretching his mouth in a grim line.
Sure.
I took the letter from his hands and laid it on the bar to keep it steady enough for me to read. There was no opening greeting, just cramped paragraphs crowding the elegant slip of stationery. You don't know who I am, but I have been watching you for a long time, Jane. Gabriel Nightingale isn't the man you think he is. He's not even the vampire you think he is. Gabriel takes advantage of those who are weaker. He doesn't care for you. He is incapable of caring for anyone but himself. Even his jealousy and possessiveness, his claims that he wants to protect you, come from his desire to own you, to keep you to himself, like a favorite toy, until he is through playing with you. I was once like you, young and innocent. Gabriel claimed he was drawn to me because of that innocence, my goodness. He said he could follow my scent across the world, that it was part of what bonded me to him. He said he loved me. Foolishly, I thought he was exciting and dashing, a dark prince taking me away from a life of boredom, from a gilded cage of limitations and demands. He killed me. He damned me, as he has damned you. You are nothing special. You are not different from any girl who has ever walked the earth, despite what he may have told you. And when you have served your purpose, he will grow tired of you. He will use and abandon you as he used and abandoned me. I know where you go. I know with whom you spend your time. You seem to enjoy your little life. For your sake, for the sake of the people you care about, you should stay away from Gabriel. A concerned and vigilant friend. I looked down and saw the corner of a photo sticking out of the envelope. I tipped it and slid several photos out into my hands. I gasped as I recognized the subjects. Gabriel and I in a hotel room. The camera was obviously outside a window, but I had no idea where we were or when the picture had been taken. We were stretched out on one of the wide hotel beds, a rare moment of relaxation on the trip from hell. My feet were draped across Gabriel's lap as he painted my toenails a delicate strawberry color. There was another picture of us in London as we walked toward the theater. I was wearing the red dress I'd bought just to attend a performance of As You Like It. There was a photo taken while we were in Rome. I was sitting at a little outdoor cafe, alone and looking worried because Gabriel had just gotten up to take another business call. Another photo of me, this time alone on my front porch swing, reading New Moon by Stephanie Meyer, a book I'd chosen in hopes of exercising my own traumatic vampire breakup issues. The camera seemed focused on the teardrop trailing down my cheek, as if that was the whole point of the picture. The final photo featured Andrea, Jolene, and me sprawled out in my living room watching TV. Andrea had seen someone at my window that night. This person had taken pictures of us, laughing and eating junk food. They probably followed me out into the woods on my idiot's errand. I realized how foolish I'd been to leave the house. This person could have doubled back to the house and hurt Andrea, hurt Jolene and her babies. My stomach twisted into a cold, watery knot. This person had followed us for months, had been privy to intimate, happy moments I wanted to keep private, had enjoyed watching me work through pain. My fangs snuck over my lip. The razor-sharp tips caught the tender flesh and made blood well into my mouth, sending my senses into overdrive. I growled.
"Janie, what's wrong? What does it say?"
While I was reading, Zeb had stepped around the bar and had an arm wrapped around me.
"Bad news?"
I fought to get my temper in check, to get my emotions under control. I didn't want to worry Zeb with this. He had enough to deal with, worrying over Jolene and the babies. Through force of will and a barrage of unappetizing imagery, basically any episode of CSI, I made my fangs retract.
"No."
I blew out a breath and faked a smile as I refolded the letter over the photos and stuck them under the counter. "It's fine. Just really persistent junk mail."
"It doesn't look like junk mail. What's with all the pictures?"
"Don't worry about it, Zeb." Zeb didn't seem convinced, but then customers started coming in, and I didn't have time to answer questions. I waited until Zeb's back was turned to fish the letter out and read it again. Obviously, this concerned and vigilant friend was the same person who sent Gabriel letters in Europe. Was it the mysterious Janine, the woman whose name had popped up frequently on Gabriel's cell phone in the last year? And if it was, who the hell was she? And how long ago had Gabriel used and abandoned her? And perhaps the most important question, what was she doing in the Hollow? Chapter 8. It's important to remember to spend time with your family. It's important to temper your absorption into the vampire culture with contact with the human world. Love Bites, a female vampire's guide to less destructive relationships. When a smell is powerful enough to wake a vampire up at noon, it's time to call an exorcist. The sex dreams hadn't subsided since that horrible fight with Gabriel at the shop. In fact, they seemed to grow more intense after Gabriel's return. In this particular dream, I was strapped into complicated Victorian underwear. Gabriel was wearing an old-fashioned cutaway tux. We were in an expensive-looking hotel room, lit by gas lamps. Still clad in his white shirt sleeves, an enthusiastic Gabriel peeled my corset away, pushed me back onto the bed, and kissed his way from the curve of my linen-covered breast to the lacy little pantaloons I was wearing. He smiled up at me, the way he used to when we made love, as if I was the most beautiful creature on the planet. I felt my human flesh grow warm and pliable under his hands. He stripped the last of my underthings away, lapping away at my core with strong, sure strokes. He nibbled and kissed until I was panting. When he finally touched the very tip of his tongue to that vital little bundle of nerves, I exploded, screaming his name as I rode wave after wave of dark, shuddering ecstasy. And then I felt the pain. My eyes flew open. Gabriel's fangs were sunk deep into the flesh of my thigh, twin trickles of blood flowing onto the sheets as he fed greedily. He snarled up at me, my blood dripping obscenely from his fangs. I screamed again, for entirely different reasons, and he launched himself at me, snapping his teeth against my throat and draining me. He rolled away, sated, and disappeared into the sheets. Horrified, I raised my bloody hands and saw them turn slowly gray. They seemed to decompose before my very eyes. I was a corpse, rotting and decayed. That certainly explained the smell. I woke up with a start and immediately clamped my hand over my nose. As I shook off the last blood-smeared images of the dream, my stomach roiled. I had not smelled anything that foul since an 18-wheeler packed with live hogs overturned near my elementary school. My nostrils actually burned with the sense of decaying fish and ammonia. I sat up slowly, my body sluggish in the wake of the peaking sun. I felt as if I was swimming through molasses. I pressed a dirty sock against my nose, which frankly smelled a lot better than whatever was wafting through my house. "Aunt Jetty!" I yelled. "Has there been a septic tank explosion?" Ignoring the weird cotton-wool sensation of daylight consciousness inside my head, I padded toward the stairs. The smell was getting stronger. I steadied myself and resisted a strong urge to gag. I crept downstairs and checked the bathroom to make sure there hadn't been some sort of sewer mishap.
"What you doing, honey?"
Jetty asked, appearing over my shoulder as I carefully took the lid off the toilet tank.
"Do you have any idea what you're looking at?"
"Not particularly. I'm just trying to figure out where the stench of death is coming from. No offense."
"None taken. What stench?"
"You don't smell that?"
"I don't smell anything. I don't have a nose,"
Aunt Jetty reminded me gently.
"Trust me, you got the better end of the deal."
I wandered toward the front door, my eyes watering as the smell took on a new, hideous note with every step. It was coming from the porch. Fitz was waiting by the door, thumping his tail on the floor because he thought I was about to let him out. Obviously, whatever was out there, Fitz was desperate to roll in it. Considering the great dead skunk caper of 2002, this was not a good sign. I put on the Jackie O sunglasses, a heavy raincoat of Aunt Jetty's, and a floppy straw hat, and wrapped a scarf around my face. I pulled back the blackout curtains and hissed at the slap in the face even obscured noontime sunlight dealt me. I squinted through the light. I couldn't see any dead animals or toxic waste strewn across the lawn, but it did seem to get stronger the closer I got to the window glass. I snapped the curtain shut and backed away. Fitz whined and did the "let me out to play" dance. I gently shoved him away from the door. "Sorry, buddy, I don't think they make doggy shampoo strong enough." There was no way I could leave the house to clean it up, so I was stuck. I went to the attic, the farthest point of the house away from the porch, and slept on an old velvet sofa. Well, I tossed and turned and kept a pillow clamped over my face. When the sun finally set, I grabbed my car wash supplies out of the garage and dragged the hose to the porch. There was a slimy, creamy yellow substance smeared on the front door, the banister, the porch swing, the railing, the boards of the porch itself. It smelled like burnt almonds and the orifice of a dead horse. Smashed against the front door was a weird-looking round hull, the size of a volleyball. It looked like a spiky, greenish coconut.
"What in the name of all that's holy is this?" I wondered, holding the shell at arm's length.
I turned to see Zeb's car pulling to a stop in front of the house.
"Hey, Jolene sent me over with some flyers for the next FOTU meeting."
His head tilted at the curious object in my hand.
"Where did you get..."
"Mother of God!"
Zeb yelled.
"What is that smell?"
"I don't know. I think my front porch has been slimed or possibly defiled by a sea monster."
I held up my fingers to show him the buttery yuck.
"I've been trapped in the house all day while this stuff baked in the hot sun. I just wish I knew what this thing was so I would know which hazmat team to call."
A smug grin spread across Zeb's face, and he crossed his arms and leaned back in the porch swing. "What?" I asked. "Care to let me in on the joke?" He examined his fingernails nonchalantly.
"I'm just reveling in knowing something you don't. So, this is what it feels like, to be the smartest person in the room. I like it. I feel all tingly."
"Zeb."
"Sorry,"
he said, nudging the husk with his foot.
"That's a durian. I saw it on the Travel Channel. That guy who thinks turtle gallbladders are a great lunch option swears they're a delicacy. He did a whole segment on them for his Indonesia episode. You know, people are seriously injured, even killed by these things every year. They fall out of the trees when they're ripe and splat. It's like having a spiny cannonball dropped on your skull. Zeb sniffed. The odor is so strong that Asian governments have banned them from subways, elevators, hotel rooms, basically any enclosed space where people can't escape the smell. You're enjoying your position as smart guy way too much, I told him. So someone brought stinky fruit all the way from Indonesia to play the world's cruelest olfactory joke on me? How do I get rid of it? Burn down the house? Zeb rolled up his sleeves and held out his hands for a brush. A little elbow grease, some borax, perhaps a nuclear device. Thank you, that's very helpful, I said, slapping the scrub brush into his palm. The smell did not come out. We scrubbed for hours to de-slime the porch, but apparently the wood of River Oaks is very absorbent. The project did give us quality time to spend together not talking. I resisted my natural urge to jabber and just worked. Companionable silence was sort of nice. It felt mature. Zeb finally broke when he realized that we'd nearly scrubbed the paint off my porch but hadn't made a dent in the smell.
I think we made the smell angry, Zeb said, wrinkling his nose. The good news is that we just happen to have intimate information of a personal nature about a certain vampire who knows how to obtain a pressure washer at 11 p.m.
One, I hope you mean Dick, I said, as he dialed his cell phone. And two, whatever intimate personal information you have about Dick, please don't share it with me. We went inside for some cold drinks. Zeb stripped his shirt off, wiping the durian remains from his hands. You know what? I have to say the whole unkempt workman thing is a good look for you. You should go home to Jolene right now, all sweaty and manly.
I can't. I smell like... He shuddered. I can't go home to Jolene like this. I'm always telling her not to come home stinky after she's rolled in something dead.
I stretched out on the front porch steps, flexing my tired legs. Wait, you do mean in wolf form, right?
Yeah,
he said, looking at me as if I was the crazy one. Your marriage is not like other marriages, I told him. So how are you guys? Have you adjusted to the whole twins thing yet?
You were right,
he said sheepishly. I smirked. I usually am. I don't have much of a choice in the matter. The babies are on their way, so the best thing to do is just hold on and enjoy the ride. And when you think about it, it's pretty cool, he said, pausing to take a drink. Besides, Jolene's cousin Raylene is having triplets, so it could be worse.
Well, there you go.
Zeb wiped his forehead off and considered.
This stinky fruit drive-by is a weird thing to do to someone. Do you think Gabriel did it?
This isn't really Gabriel's style. This involves a certain whimsical malice that he lacks. Besides, he's not mad at me. He just can't seem to grasp why I'm mad at him, which is infuriating. And even when he was mad at me, he was much more likely to lecture me sternly or give me a spanking than leave putrid fruit paste on my porch.
I'm going to ignore the spanking reference, he said under his breath.
Probably for the best, I agreed.
So who do you think is the fruit bomber?
I shrugged. Could be some random person in town who doesn't like vampires. Could be a member of the Chamber of Commerce who's decided they don't want me there after all. Now that's the place for whimsical malice. Heck, this could be Dick's idea of a hilarious practical joke to lift my spirits. It could be anybody.
That's not comforting, Zeb said.
Or, I thought, it could be my mysterious pen pal, hoping I would be disoriented enough from lack of sleep and olfactory overdrive to stumble out of the house in full daylight to investigate the smell. It sucks to be this popular, I said, reaching into the front hall to pull out my purse. Which is why I went to the scary sporting goods store last night and bought this. I pulled my new stun gun out of its holster and pressed the trigger, smiling as the arc of current connected between the two prongs.
You bought a stun gun? He cried. Why did you buy a stun gun?
Do you want to smell my porch again? I asked. There's some stuff going on right now, Zeb. I need something for protection, and I lost the mace Gabriel gave me. And I lost Gabriel. I can't depend on anybody to protect me. I think we can agree that buying a gun would be much more likely to end in my shooting myself or innocent bystanders.
But you're a vampire. You have super strength. I've seen you kill someone with your bare hands.
Well, there was a wooden stake in your bare hands, but still.
I don't like carrying this thing around with me either, Zeb. You know me, I only resort to violent impulses when I feel I have no option. Or you're cranky, or startled, or your blood sugar is low, or you have a hangnail.
I cut him off with a glare.
This will keep me doing too much damage to the other person while still giving me enough time to get away. And this will keep me from getting my hands dirty, or, you know, dusty.
You know you're going to end up electrocuting yourself, right?
I know it's highly likely, I conceded. As if I didn't have enough odd, emotionally hamstrung men in my life, Emery Mueller started spending a lot of time at the shop. A lot of time. Enough time that I started to consider making up with Gabriel just so he could reach into Emery's brain and wipe out any memory he had of where the shop was located. It was a skill neither Dick nor I possessed. After seeing that I would not be closing the shop after all, Emery claimed that he wanted to keep an eye on the family interests. So he spent every night at the shop, annoying the hell out of Andrea with questions about her alternative lifestyle. It appeared that he developed a bit of a crush on my favorite blood surrogate and frequently asked her to join him at church. When she refused, he blamed it on the influence of her unfortunate choice of suitors and spent most of his time giving her the moon eyes. Andrea spent most of her time trying not to be creeped out by her boyfriend's great-great-grandson's advances. How many women could say they have that problem? Dick stopped showing up on Wednesday nights, claiming he was calling in sick for terminal disappointment. At least he offered an excuse. Mr. Wainwright just disappeared. Emery became my own personal Mr. Collins, an irritating rash in human form. And just like the supercilious, socially inept minister from Pride and Prejudice, he got bolder with every visit. First, he asked to see a copy of his uncle's will, which I happily provided, along with copies of his uncle's bank statements at the time of his death. However, I started to get annoyed when Emery demanded copies of the current books for the shop, along with inventory lists, my own financial records, and a list of any books I may have taken from the shop. He commented on the number of sales per night, on the high overhead involved in the coffee bar. Then he took up residence behind the counter and casually went through drawers he had no business opening. The more time I spent with him, the less I wanted to give him. I felt the need to protect Mr. Wainwright's possessions from his sweaty, grasping hands. "Do you happen to know a woman named Jenny McBride?" I asked after he requested the contact information for Mr. Wainwright's lawyer so he could set up an appointment with him. "About yay tall, blonde, judgmental?" "Hey, considering that my sister was inadvertently in cahoots with Missy the psycho realtor, I considered it a fair question." Emery's response was an expression both confused and constipated. For some reason, his not comprehending exactly how annoying his behavior was brought all of my repressed Gabriel-related anger to the surface. I felt the need either to slap Emery or warn him that I was about to slap him.
"I'm only looking after my uncle's legacy, Jane," he sniffed. "You've made valiant attempts to organize the stock, but to be honest, you've only made a small dent in the problem. You have library experience, but that doesn't make you an expert on antique or rare occult books. Frankly, I don't think you know what you have here. You could let a priceless volume walk out of the store for a song and not even realize it. I think you should shut down for a few days and let me bring in an appraiser to look over the older stock."
"With all due respect, Emery, since your uncle left that legacy to me, it's mine to sell if I want to, at any price," I said. "In fact, I'm not legally bound to offer you anything beyond mementos from Mr. Wainwright's personal effects, but I'm trying to be nice. Now, when I took over the shop, I got a new insurance policy, and I have estimates for the value of the stock. I'll give you copies of that. But as far as giving you a complete inventory or letting you have some outsider go through the stock title by title, I'm afraid that's not going to be possible."
"And why not?"
Emery demanded, his face flushing an unpleasant shade of purple. "Because I said no," I said in my talking to preschooler's voice.
"I don't see why you listen to every bit of advice Andrea and that Dick character give you. But you just write off everything I have to say. They don't have the vested family interest in the store that I do.
They're my family," I shot back, tapping into my reservoir of Gabriel-related anger. And they spent more time with your uncle in the last months of his life than you did in the last 10 years. Emery blanched as if I'd slapped him.
I think I should go somewhere else before we say anything we're going to regret.
Emery made a show of slinking out the door with a kicked puppy dog expression. Andrea poked her head out of the supply closet where she'd been hiding.
You got Emery to leave after less than an hour? Can you teach me how to do that?
Unfortunately, by somewhere else, Emery did not mean he was leaving the shop permanently. Oh, no. He stayed and stayed and stayed. He sat at the coffee bar and made moon eyes at Andrea. He hung around in the stacks, claiming to be looking for a few books that held special sentimental attachment for him. I'd hidden the books with the naked lady bump engravings. He annoyed newly turned vampires by trying to get them to take religious tracts. Hell, even Cindy the goth mascot would turn and walk out if she saw Emery. She'd gone 4 consecutive days without a latte. I was starting to worry. For me, the breaking point was when Emery interrupted my reading yet another letter from my concerned and vigilant friend. This one, telling me how Gabriel had taken her from an innocent, sexually inexperienced girl to a strung-out love junkie by assuring her that he enjoyed her naivete, her unpredictability. I remember feeling Emery standing over my shoulder as I read,
Gabriel told me that he liked not knowing what I would do or say. He said my innocence was a refreshing change. I don't have to ask whether he said the same to you. He says this to all of the women he beds. He is as skilled at lying as he is at loving. His ability to manipulate emotions through just the right mix of sweetness and feigned overprotection is unparalleled.
What do you have there, Jane?
Emery asked. I ignored him. I remember Emery clearing his throat and holding his too soft hand out imperiously, as if I was caught reading his mail. My upper lip pulled back from my teeth in what I considered a warning expression. But Emery was oblivious to it, and the hostile tension that seemed to be rolling off me in waves. I remember turning my shoulder slightly so my back was to him and continuing to read. Emery's fingers closed over the top of the page and pulled it out of my hands. I think I had some sort of rage blackout because I do not remember snarling and flashing my fangs so viciously that Emery ran out of the store. But Andrea said there was a small urine stain on the carpet to prove it, so I had to believe her. Andrea and I both made elaborate and sadistic threats against Dick if he didn't take his great-great-grandson out for some quality time. Andrea's threats were far more effective, as they apparently involved refusal of certain privileges. So Dick took Emery out for an evening of bonding and bowling, practically by force. I hoped Emery would end up with a really embarrassing tattoo. With the shop cleared of Emery's presence, I yelled, "Okay, Mr. Wainwright, you can come out now. It's safe." He materialized, looking a little chagrined. "So, what have you been up to?" I asked cheerfully, then glared at him.
"Jane, I'm sorry."
"Uh-huh," I said, narrowing my gaze, but eventually smiling despite myself. "You said Emery was eccentric and personality-free. You didn't tell me that he was..."
"An enormous pain in the rear?"
Mr. Wainwright suggested. I was going to say infuriating pustule on the butt cheek of humanity, but yeah. "He's driving me crazy. He questions every decision I make. He insinuates himself into conversations and situations that are none of his business. It's like hanging out with my mom, only without the loving part." Mr. Wainwright put his insubstantial hand on my shoulder.
"He has that effect on people. I'm surprised you lasted this long."
"Humph. I just don't think I can let him come around the shop anymore, Mr. Wainwright. I mean, he's chasing customers away. I just got the place up and running, and he's killing sales."
"By all means, toss him out on his sanctimonious keister. It will be good for him."
"Excellent," I breathed.
"By the way, I thought you had a Chamber of Commerce meeting tonight,"
he asked.
"You have it marked on the calendar in the office with little skulls and crossbones. Really, you executed an amazing amount of detail with a Sharpie."
"Yes," I grumbled. "I do have a meeting, but I really don't want to go.
But I was so proud of your joining the chamber. I had no patience for that sort of thing, really. There were too many people involved.
There still are, I muttered. I really don't think the chamber is for me after all, Mr. Wainwright. Those women are just, well, they're just mean. They've called every day for the last week to remind me that as the newest member, I am responsible for bringing at least 3 kinds of mild cheese, wheat crackers, and 4 bottles of California White. And I'm supposed to submit weekly progress reports on how my quest for freebies is going. When I suggested that this was excessive, I was given 5 demerits. I don't even know what that means. There has to be something going on. Demon possession or a man-hating cult or, ooh, witches. They could be witches.
Isn't that kind of obvious?
He asked. Don't use logic on me.
Jane, you're not a quitter.
Well, that's just not true. Nice Courtney was the only chamber member who was happy to see me walking through the door with my basket of yuppie goodies.
Jane, honey,
she cried, breaking from the pack to greet me at the door of the chamber house and relieve me of my boozy burden.
I'm so glad you're here. We just got another new member. You've got to come meet her.
A blonde in a shell pink twin set turned when Nice Courtney tapped her on the shoulder. Jenny gasped.
What the
hell? I finished for her. Jenny looked around furtively and dragged me into the foyer.
What are you doing here?
She demanded.
I joined last month. What are you doing here?
I shot back.
I joined tonight.
You're not a business owner.
Yes, I am,
she shot back, handing me her business card. What, so I started a business and suddenly you have to start one? How transparent are you? Jenny rolled her eyes.
This has nothing to do with you.
Well, it's a hell of a coincidence.
I've wanted to start my own business for years, and now the boys are getting older. There's a huge market out there for people who would love to create a kind of memory craft, but can't so much as cut a straight line. People like you. I'm just making it a little more upscale. And technically, you didn't start one. You inherited it, just like you've inherited everything else. The house, Missy's Holdings, the shop.
Is your long-term plan based on making friends with the elderly chamber members so they remember you in their wills? There are no elderly chamber members. The Courtneys sacrificed them to their evil god, I growled, ignoring the confused look on Jenny's face as she searched the room for a face over 40. And I don't think I'm going to take crap off someone who is trying to smuggle valuables out of my house in her craft bag. Jenny protested.
I wasn't stealing.
What do you call taking items that don't belong to you from someone else's home without their permission? Aggressive borrowing?
I'm not going to have this conversation with you now, Jane. You're being ridiculous. Look, no one here has to know that we're related,
Jenny said, glancing around.
We can pretend not to know each other. You can be some person I don't know that well and don't want to spend time with.
Fine, fine. It'll be just like school. You stay on your side and I'll stay on mine. I turned on my heel and rifled through my bag. Where the hell is the wine? I stuck my fingernail in the cork and used a tiny bit of vampire strength to pop it out. I did, however, manage to resist the urge to glug straight from the bottle and snagged a wine glass instead. Full glass in hand, I stomped off to find Nice Courtney. She gave me a questioning look as I took her wine glass and drained it.
Do you two know each other?
Apparently not, I muttered. Head Courtney called the meeting into session. I stewed while Jenny was introduced and officially welcomed into the group. There was clapping and squealing and cooing. It was a noticeably warmer reception than what I received. They even gave her a little pink rose corsage.
Typical.
My sister had decided to take her love of scrapbooking to another level. The scary level. She started a company called Elegant Memories, a personalized and customized scrapbooking service using specialty handmade papers made from the hairs of Turkish virgins or something. Of course, she was accepted into the fold like a Borg returning to the collective. The fact that I could correctly make a reference to the Borg was probably part of the reason I was not being accepted into the collective. I spent most of the meeting plotting ways of getting Jenny out of the chamber. Shaving her head came up, or telling Head Courtney that Jenny was a natural brunette. Somehow all of my solutions were hair-related. And then I switched to trying to find ways of getting me out of the chamber, which was less productive since I was interrupted by...
Jane,
Head Courtney repeated sternly.
Huh?
I asked how the prize collections were going.
Crap! Head Courtney had sent me a strongly worded email listing the acceptable prize options for the fall festival. Gift baskets, gift certificates of no less than $100 each, vacation packages. Very few businesses that were not chamber members were willing to give up such treasures for what was essentially a children's carnival. So far, a doctor's office had given me oversized promotional pens advertising a drug for erectile dysfunction, and I'd charmed a local beauty shop out of a gift certificate for a free lip waxing. Not well, actually. I managed to get a few things, but with the number of participants you're talking about, it's just not going to be enough. I was thinking maybe we need to change our focus for the carnival prizes. I was thinking we might aim for smaller items, so we would have plenty of small, inexpensive prizes instead of a few big prizes. Things like stuffed animals and candy, you know, things that kids would like to win. Since this was supposedly a kids' carnival and all. Head Courtney's lips pressed together in a tight, pissed-off line. Jane, I must not have explained your assignment thoroughly enough in the repeated emails I sent you. It's not that, I just think... Head Courtney snapped. I didn't tell you to think. I told you to gather prizes for the fall festival. I had a brief, colorful fantasy of latching onto her neck and drinking her dry, but I reconsidered instantly. I'd read somewhere that Botox turns the blood bitter and astringent. Instead, I smiled thinly and said, "That's kind of condescending." Head Courtney sniffed. "Maybe you're not chamber material after all, Jane." "A way out! A way out!" I started to reach for my purse. "If you really feel that way..." Toady Courtney stood up and whispered to Head Courtney something along the lines of, "But none of us wants to do it either." "Dang it." Head Courtney cleared her throat. "Since you're struggling with your very simple assignment, Jenny is going to be joining your committee."
"What?"
Jenny cried.
"Why?"
I yelled. "Why would you do that?" "Jenny has the organizational and people skills necessary to complete the task." Damned if she didn't have a point there. Jenny spluttered.
"Courtney, I don't think this is a good idea."
"Now, Jenny, new chamber members are expected to make sacrifices. You want to make a good impression, don't you?"
But,
Jenny stammered. Okay, that made me giggle a little. Nice Courtney leaned over and whispered,
"What's so funny?"
"Nothing," I assured her. "Absolutely nothing." Jenny and I were assigned a meeting schedule, a color-coded chart to record our progress, and little pamphlets with suggestions on what phrases to use to encourage donations. If we didn't collect at least 200 items by the next meeting, we would both be given 20 demerits. Eventually, I was going to have to ask Nice Courtney what that meant, exactly. Chapter 9. It's normal to relapse into old patterns. The important thing is to try to avoid hurting bystanders. Love Bites, A Female Vampire's Guide to Less Destructive Relationships. I was not invited to the McLean clan baby shower. After my participation in Zeb and Jolene's disastrous wedding events, I was considered a bit of an event jinx by Jolene's family. So they held it at noon, outdoors, at the McLean family farm. I'm not sure if my absence made the party better or worse for Jolene. Apparently, because the McLeans are such a fertile family, baby showers aren't so much gift-giving occasions, but a recycling of the most recent baby's clothes, blankets, and so on for the use of the new arrival. They do wrap the items for the new mother to open, though. There was cake. There was a corsage of roses made from tiny baby socks. There were hostile cousins, who still resented Jolene as the golden child of the pack, despite her humbling experience at her wedding rehearsal when Zeb dumped her while under the influence of post-hypnotic suggestion. It's a long story. As Jolene's pregnancy progressed, the McLeans had stepped up their campaign to keep Zeb and Jolene's home from being built. The pack had scared off every construction crew in three counties, showing up during the day to supervise the work. When the more obtuse crews didn't pick up on the subtle intimidation, the pack would use scary subliminal wolf behavior to scare them off. Prolonged stares, low growls, and, in one instance, peeing on a plumber's van. The Lavelle house was basically a concrete pad and some framework that had been up for so long it was starting to buckle under the elements.
Jolene and Zeb had no choice but to hire Buster Dowdy, the laziest contractor in this end of the state. He frequently spent his billable hours at the site, in the back of his truck, drinking beer and napping. The climax of the shower was a weird diaper-related shower game in which the prize was being allowed in the delivery room when Jolene's babies were born. Jolene had not been informed of this, and she vehemently protested when her cousin Lurleen, the current president of the We Hate Jolene Club, was named the lucky winner.
"Stop laughing,"
Jolene cried later as she told me and Andrea how she tried to explain that watching her deliver twins wasn't something Jolene was willing to raffle off. We were an odd combination, the vampire, the human, and the weeping werewolf. But it felt right, somehow, for us to be sitting in the trailer's tiny guest room, sorting through baby clothes and comforting Jolene. Andrea and I were now a safety net for her. Jolene wailed,
"It's not funny. They just do not get why I don't think that was a wonderful way to end the shower. Aunt Bonnie said that they were trying to help keep me from abandoning family tradition altogether, since my human husband is insisting I go to some silly hospital instead of having a home birth like every other woman in the family for the last 30 generations. And then Lurleen got to pretend that her feelings were hurt because I wouldn't let her share in this moment and help me through labor. We both know damn good and well that Lurleen doesn't give two sniffs about being there.
Stop laughing!" "I'm sorry," I cried, trying to stifle the giggles that were so clearly pissing off the hormonally imbalanced and extremely swollen werewolf. "It's indignant laughter. On your behalf." Jolene sniffed as she tried to fold a tiny pink sleeper for the fourth time, finally bunching it into a ball and tossing it into a laundry basket.
"And then Mama said they had a surprise for me, and I thought, oh, Lord, what now? And they covered my eyes and led me across the pasture, and surprise, there's a brand new trailer sitting there with the Lavelles already burned onto one of those little wooden porch signs. Mama said the family wanted to help me and Zeb since they'd heard how much trouble we'd been having with building the new house. They took me inside, and it was so big."
She looked around the cramped confines of the camper.
"It was one of those big double-wides with a gas fireplace and a master bathroom with separate shower. They already had it all decorated, and..."
She sighed.
"It was so pretty and new and clean. Did I mention it was new?"
Andrea smiled gently and patted Jolene's hands.
"A few times. So are you going to be moving in?"
"No,"
Jolene said, fully tearing up now.
"Because then they showed me the nursery, and they already had it all set up. They'd already picked out all this Noah's Ark stuff, quilts and a crib set and this big mural thing on the wall. I mean, they'd done everything, and they hadn't even asked me. They never ask me. They always just assume that they're doing what's best for me.
Aunt Bonnie started talking about how silly it was for me to want to move off the farm anyway, since I was going to need so much help with the babies, and how it would just be so much easier for everybody this way.
And I realized it was never going to change. I'd be stuck there,
and they'd just be constantly coming in without being invited and taking over everything and treating Zeb bad. And I lost it." "What exactly does lost it mean?" I asked, knowing full well that werewolf family arguments usually devolved into full-scale riot situations.
"I told them no. For the first time, I really, completely, no doubt about it, said no. No to the nursery, no to the trailer, no to the little wooden sign, just no. I told them I knew that the reason we were having so much trouble finishing the house was that they were scaring off all the contractors. I told them I wasn't going to move back to the farm ever, no matter what they did. I told them they'd be lucky if Zeb and I told them where we were going to the hospital to have the babies, much less allowed them to barge into the delivery room. I told them I would raise my babies how I saw fit, and if they wanted to visit after the twins were born, they would have to call before coming over. Otherwise, we weren't answering the door." Andrea's jaw was hanging freely at this point. All I could do was mouth, "Wow." Jolene sighed. "Yeah," and Mama burst into tears. Aunt Lola kept asking everybody what I really meant. Aunt Bonnie said that if I felt that way, then she guessed I didn't want their shower gifts.
I told Aunt Bonnie to take her used diaper genie and shove it up her ass sideways.